I'm Rachel.
I'm Simon.
And this is episode 138. Gosh, so many episodes.
So many.
Today we're going to be starting off by talking about authors' lives. Do they matter or not? Is that all right as a summary?
Yeah. What, do we care about authors' personal lives?
Personal lives, yes or no? And this is thank you to Lindsay who's given us this suggestion, because Simon and I have run out of all suggestions.
Long ago.
Very welcome. Very long time ago. And then in the second half, we're going to be discussing two books that I've had on my shelf for a very long time, which I suggested last time. The first being The Beautiful Visit by Elizabeth Jane Howard, and the second, The Passionate Life of
The Lonely Passion of Judith Hearn.
It's a complicated title, by Brian Moore. So
I think maybe republished just as Judith Hearn at some point.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, that would make life easier as a title, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't it, Jess?
The Lonely Passion of Judith Hearn, yes. So, Simon, how are you? What's going on? What are you reading?
Yeah, as we record, it is Bank Holiday Monday, celebrating, I guess, May.
Is that what we're wishing? We don't know. It just means we have a day off work.
Exactly. It is also, I guess, Cinco de Mayo, but I don't think we particularly celebrate that in the UK. And I've been away in a lovely cottage in Berkshire, which was fun. Back to reality now. But there are two books I was going to mention that I finished both of them, but they're both excellent. So I wanted to bring them to people's attention. Ooh. One is a book called Recommended! By Nicola Wilson, which I got a review copy. I'm not sure if it's published yet, but it's about the Book Society. And Nicola sent it to me because we were in touch a little bit, because I worked on the Book Society during my doctorate, and she, you know, knows obviously infinitely more about it than I do. But the Book Society was one of the first Book of the Month clubs in the UK, starting in 1929 and going through to, I've just finished the book, I should know this, the 60s, I think. But the book, this non-fiction account of it, focuses on those early years and through the Second World War. And the latter history of the club is sort of whipped through it. And yeah, there was a panel of well-known authors, including people like Hugh Walpole, J.B. Priestley was on at one point, Sylvia Lind, maybe less well-known, and I've got a blank on the other person who started it, but Clemence Dane, there we go. And yeah, they would meet together, choose, recommend a book and their various other titles. People who've read Diary of a Provincial Lady will remember it, the Book Society being referenced a few times there. And it's a fascinating insight into sort of cultural history of a newly, or the new accessible publishing, I guess, and newly disposable income middle classes trying to better themselves, and the sort of books that were sent to them, which, you know, the Book of the Month Club now we might expect to be maybe a beach read if it's like Rich and Judy Book Club, or maybe some literary stuff, but crowd pleaser stuff. Whereas you look at the things that the Book Society are recommending and it's like a biography of some Russian general or something. It really, really esoteric at times. But Nicola Wilson does a really brilliant job at going through the history of the society, and also the different, the panel of judges and their lives and how they interact. And I absolutely loved it. And I mean, I have spent some time researching the Book Society during my doctorate, and I know how hard it is to find any information about it. So I'm in awe of the amount of stuff she's managed to unearth about it. So I really recommend that. And it is called Recommended. And the novel I've read that recently that I really loved is called Blue Postcards by Douglas Bruton, who I'd not heard of. I bought it because it looked interesting. And it's a novel or novella told in 500 vignette paragraphs about Yves Klein, the artist famous for painting monochrome, particularly in blue, painting sculptures blue and all that sort of thing. And a tailor called Henri who makes a suit for him. I think he's made up. And then the narrator, 50 years later, sort of thinking about it, and all of them have differing obsessions with the color blue. And it's just, yeah, really interesting, unusual, and oddly captivating books. I really recommend that. Have you read any Douglas Bruton?
No, never heard of him.
I thought he was sort of, I hadn't heard of him until I picked that up. So when I mentioned it on Instagram or something, there were a few people like, oh, you must read everything he's read. And someone else I knew, Madame Bibliophile's blog, she was reading one. So I was like, oh, maybe he's more well-known than I realised. But maybe he is, I don't know. But I certainly want to read more by him now.
Wow. I mean, both of those sound amazing.
Yeah, I'm having a good reading period at the moment. Yeah, except one of the books we're doing today, sneak preview. But what are you reading at the moment? How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. It's been a busy week for me. I've been on a school trip to Berlin with 50 students. So yes. That was quite tiring in a heat wave as well. But, you know, gave me an excuse to get a tan and got to see a bit of Berlin, which I've never visited before. So that was quite nice. And especially after I'd read Perfection that I've talked about on here before. By Vincenzo Latronico, which is one of the International Booker Prize shortlisted books, which is set in Berlin. It was interesting being there and sort of recognizing what he talks about in the book and the architecture and things. It was enabled me to kind of enrich my experience. And I thought, oh, I'll go back and reread the book now I've been. So that was quite nice. Needless to say, I didn't read anything while I was in Berlin. However, I did finally finish reading Stasiland before I went by Anna Funder, which I've mentioned before, but I hadn't been reading it at the time. And I would really highly recommend it because it was really shocking, actually, to me to read about what governments have done in living memory and going to Berlin and actually seeing the kind of evidence still there and going to a few of the museums where you get to see the stories of people and the realities of what their life was like, within my own lifetime is just madness. So, I really enjoyed that. And I look forward to seeing what Anna Funder writes next, actually, because she wrote Wifedom about George Orwell's wife. And I think that was published about, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago. So she must be working on something else. So Anna Funder, hurry up.
If you're listening,
please do get on with your next book for us. And then this weekend, I went on Saturday to Bath for the first time in about 15 years. I was trying to
work
an event. And obviously, my first port of call was Persephone Books, which is very exciting. I've not been there since they opened their branch. So it was really exciting to go in. And it was kind of like the shop in Bloomsbury used to be, but not. And I bought their new book, Crooked Cross by Sally Carson, which is set during World War II in Germany. So there's lots of theme, but Germany just keeps coming back to me at the moment. So I'm looking forward to reading that. I haven't opened it yet. And obviously I've been reading The Lonely Passion of Judith Hearn, which I did actually read on the plane to Berlin. And I'm very proud of myself at the moment because for the last couple of months I've set myself a target not to buy any new books until I've got through the pile on my desk. And I am one book away from the bottom of the pile.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And I'm really excited by that because that pile has been there for about a year.
How does that anecdote fit with you just buying the Persephone book?
Well, I had to because I was in the shop.
I mean, look, I'm not going to say you shouldn't.
And the cost of postage these days. And I wanted the new book. And I thought, well, if I wait, then I'm going to have to pay extra. And also I was in the shop and, you know, you have to support.
I should have let that slide. Sorry. No, you're quite right. Very well.
And it's my birthday. So
it's your birthday. Happy birthday, Rachel. Happy birthday
tomorrow. It was actually really a birthday present to myself, which I felt was okay.
Can I also just say, unrelated to this, Hargreaves is very energetically washing himself on my lap next to the microphone. So if you can hear weird like slathering, that's what it is. I just want people to know that.
Getting a very odd impression of you, right?
I know, exactly. He stopped now. Thanks, Hargreaves. Feeling shamed. So thank you, Lindsay, for suggesting this topic. Very grateful. I think, you know, we've done sort of similar or overlapping things at different times, but we're realizing that our next episode next month will be our 10th anniversary episode. And as we were saying before we started recording, you can't be original every episode after 10 years, surely. So we're not going to be. We're good, but we are going to talk about, do we care about authors' personal lives? What comes to mind first?
Well, I think this is a really interesting question, and I think it's one that's become increasingly contested in recent years. And I recently read, I can't remember the name of the author, but you'll look it up, won't you?
Yeah.
Called Monster, and it's about art. Probably know it, don't you? It's got a pink cover, and it's all about, you know, how do we cope, how do we deal with art when we can't respect the artist, or when the artist has done something particularly bad. And sort of the focus in the book is largely about male artists and their treatment of women in their personal lives, but, you know, in general. And while that's focused on art, in terms of, you know, visual art, it's also thinking and films and so on, I think it also applies to books. And, you know, recently Neil Gaiman has been, you know, accused of sexual misconduct, and people are now like, we can't teach, because his books are commonly taught in school. So there's been lots of talk amongst teachers with, well, shall we take his books off the syllabus? And there's another author at the moment where it's at my school at the moment, we're discussing, should we still teach this, because that author's just been accused of sexual assault as well. And, you know, one of my colleagues was like, well, if, you know, if that's the case, we'll run out of books the way, you know. And I think it's interesting to think about, where do we draw the line? And I think when it comes to that sort of thing, I think it's, I mean, I don't know, I have differing opinions. I guess it depends for me on what the author's persona is, or how they've presented themselves, because certainly, and if it's a contemporary author as well, I would feel differently compared to an author who's long dead. So, you know, we've discussed a lot before how we can often be uncomfortable when we've been reading things. We've read some of Virginia Woolf's books that have got some upsetting references to class or race. And likewise with what's her name, Stella, who wrote Cold Comfort Farm. Her name's
Gibbons, yeah.
Heather Gibbons, you know, I remember we read one of her books, and there was a passage in there about Jewish people that was quite upsetting. And we talked then about people kind of like republishing these books and either putting a little thing at the beginning or taking out the offending pieces altogether, but still publishing the book. And we've had discussions about, is that appropriate? And same with Enid Blyton, you know, her books being republished for a new generation of children and taking out references. And it's like, but if Enid Blyton were writing today and she'd been known to hold those views, I think her books have been cancelled altogether. So it's interesting how we can have that kind of two thing, like dichotomy existing alongside each other. Like we know that these people in the past have held upsetting views, but it was the past, so it's okay. But these people in the present day are doing horrible things, and therefore we won't read them anymore. And I don't know, I kind of sometimes I sit with the we shouldn't. You know, I was arguing at school the other day that we shouldn't teach this book by this person. But then at the same time, I think, well, none of us are perfect. And if we start making moral arguments for reading or not reading people, then we'll end up not being able to read anybody at all, because what makes somebody bad? So I think there's lots of big, big questions.
Yeah. Before I respond to that, I wonder, how was the Monsters book? Because I've read some reviews that say it's, you know, obviously a fascinating topic, but treated quite poorly in the book. What did you think?
Oh, I thought it was a load of old tosh.
Okay.
Halfway through, it was very, I wanted it to be far more academic than it was. It was very chatty and largely based around personal anecdotes rather than any actual exploration topic, which I thought was a bit of a wasted opportunity.
That's a shame, because I was intrigued to read it, and then I mean, I've read a few reviews, none of which have been positive, and Victoria Tales from the Reading Room was the latest of those. A shame. It's interesting, I did wonder when I looked at this topic from Lindsay if this was the direction the topic were going, because it was one of the options I thought about, and I was also thinking more just about their personal lives, sort of not from through a moral lens, but like how much right or do we have to know about the personal lives of authors. Maybe we can come on to that in a bit, but I think the bit you're addressing is so hard, with particularly of dead authors, but how, especially long dead authors, to think if what they believed was not unusual, are we going to cut off all novels before 1950 or whatever? No, but then if there's particularly hateful examples, then I don't know. It is hard, and I don't think there is a good answer. With living authors, I think there's also the financial element. It's like, do I want someone I think is a terrible person to financially benefit from me reading their book?
Yeah.
Maybe not. But also, as you say, like, I think banning books and burning books is bad, even from good motives. You know, I don't think these books should be banned. We talked about that in another episode. But I also think people should have the right to read these authors if they want to without being judged, because there is that separation of art and artist that some people can cope with and some people can't. It's tricky. is in conclusion, but to think more about I was thinking about modern authors that I read, just in massive numbers, but because we've had her on the podcast, thinking Mary Lawson, for example, who, as she told us, like, she's not well connected in literary circles. There's never going to be a sort of Bloomsbury Group type memoir where she's hobnobbing with all the other famous Canadian authors of her day. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, it's absolutely none of my business what her personal life is. And she might well want to share some of it in bios and books, say who her husband is, who her, you know, where she lives. In, you know, in every book it says that she was born in Ontario and lived there until she was, whatever it was, 17, 18, 19, and then came here. But if she didn't want to say that, then there's no reason why anyone should know that. And on the flip side, when an author is dead, it somehow seems to become much more acceptable for people to bury into their past. Like, I don't think I've ever felt guilty about reading a biography. I can't think of an example where I thought, well, I shouldn't have read that, except maybe Nicola Bowman's biography of Elizabeth Taylor. Felt like her, the children were so reluctant for it to happen that some of the things she said in there, maybe we shouldn't know that. But there's something about an author being dead where it's like suddenly their personal life becomes public property in a way that is quite uncomfortable. Like, people say cross that Cassandra Austin burnt Jane Austen's letters, but if an author is alive, of course I wouldn't have any right to read their letters. So yeah, when does it suddenly become okay that we have access to their material and their secrets, or even just non-secrets? Like, when does it become my right to know the names of their children? I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, and I think there's always an interest, isn't there, in public people, and people want to know the person behind the work. And I think as well, that's become more of a thing since we've started to read work through the lens of the author's life and thinking like, oh, what part of their autobiography has influenced this, or this is a reflection of what happened to them. And, you know, wanting to read the author into their work is, I think, feeling that desire to want to delve into their past experiences and their childhood trauma and all that sort of thing. And I think if you read kind of biographies, Victorian biographies of authors, or even early 20th century biographies of authors, they're often, you know, much more factual and more focused on their kind of achievements and their education, and there's a sort of a Bildungsroman type rather than their personal lives and the dramas that might have happened to them, or, like, you know, the love affairs that went wrong and so on. Whereas biographies from the kind of 60s, 70s onwards, they've become much more gossipy and much more about unearthing hidden stories and, you know, like revealing, for example, like in Nicola Bowman's biography of Elizabeth Taylor, you know, they're having these extramarital affairs, or, you know, there was a child out of wedlock and so on. And I remember I was reading about I can't remember anyone's name today. I don't know what Dorothy L. Sayers. I was reading a biography of her, and it was talking in there about this when she was 28, she had a child outside of wedlock, and she went to great lengths to hide the existence of this child. And I was like, well, she went to great lengths to hide the existence of this child in her lifetime. She didn't want anybody to know that she'd had a child. And then this biography has kind of uncovered all this dirt on her, essentially, and casting her light in a very different way. And I think, like you say about Cassandra Austin burning Jane Austen's letters, it's this idea of, if somebody in their lifetime desired something to be hidden or didn't want something to be known about themselves, and their art existed in a different realm to their existence, we don't need to know anything about them, and we shouldn't, I think, desire to know anything about them.
Yeah, I recently read Violet Trefusis's memoirs, also Violet Kappel, same person, called Don't Look Around. And apparently Nancy Mitford referred to it as Here Lies Violet Trefusis, because there were, you know, I don't know if it was actually lying so much as things left out. Like, she is most famous now for having had an affair with Peter Sackville West, a long-standing affair with Peter Sackville West, and I believe various other women, as well as being, I think, an excellent novelist. I think Echo is particularly brilliant. But in this memoir, you certainly wouldn't know that. And she talks a lot about her husband without any indication that both of them, I believe, were having numerous affairs. And that's, like you're saying, it's become much more a recent thing. I know there's things like, you know, Eminent Victorians by Dibden Strachey sort of satirizing the genre in general earlier. But yes, until the mid 20th century at the least, and probably much later, it was, as you're saying, like a more of a glorified Wikipedia page of, you know, here are the different things that happen. And often when people write about their own autobiographies, it's much more about their childhood, and they don't go the whole confessional route until, again, more recently. And I don't know if, you know, we're in an era where the personal essay is a really big genre, and I love them. But it does feel like maybe in a post Web 2.0 era, that this idea of public confession or public detective work to unearth someone's personal life completely seems not only acceptable, but laudable. Like when, what's her name? Eleanor Ferrante, obviously is a pseudonym, and she was very clear that she didn't want her name to be known. And there was this, I can't remember which newspaper it was, but this massive investigation to find out who she was and then publish her name everywhere and be really clear about it. And it's like, well, we don't have any right to know her name. Why is it so important for you to find this, the identity of this woman who's gone to an awful lot of hard work with her and her publisher and translator and all these things to hide that information? Yeah. And as people often say, just because something interests the public doesn't mean it's in the public interest, the sort of definition for what newspapers are allowed to publish. So yeah, I don't know if maybe that curiosity was always there, but we're in an era where it's more acceptable to do it, particularly if it's done in the name of like intellectual curiosity, right? Because we're not in that era so much of like the tabloid press of the early 2000s, where the fact that people wanted to put something out there was enough, particularly if it was about a woman. But now it seems to be more like some sort of faux moralistic, we're on a quest for truth, and therefore it's acceptable for us to expose this, which is great for people like Neil Gaiman, who, when it's for allegations of actual criminal activity, but that somehow seems to seep into things that aren't criminal and aren't in any of our business, but with the same sort of moralistic tone of discovering truth.
Yes, and I think it's kind of strange, really, this idea that, well, if you put yourself out there in the public eye in any way, shape or form, then, you know, you've signed up for this sort of thing. That attitude is like, well, they haven't. They've created a piece of art and they've given you what's in the piece of art. And if they haven't revealed anything about themselves, if they've chosen not to put any personal information inside their book jacket, or they don't want to do interviews or whatever, that should be respected completely. I don't think it should matter. I mean, I actually, over the course of my teaching life, have taken on a different attitude to that. Like, I used to, when I started teaching a long time ago now, used to always give biographical information to my students before I started teaching a book about the author, and, you know, just be like, oh, right, so this is the context of, this is when they were writing, and this is who they were, and this is what they were doing. And actually now I don't really tend to do that very much, because I just think, well, it's got nothing to do with it, really. We're here to discuss the work. We're not here to discuss the author. And yeah, I've just been doing Shakespeare, and, you know, we haven't really touched on, with my sixth formers, and we've been doing Macbeth, and we haven't really touched on Shakespeare very much at all, really. We've just been talking about the text, and that's been quite freeing, because, you know, what good is it to us there to speculate about, well, you know, does it matter whether this book is about the loss of his, this play is about the loss of his son or not? Doesn't matter. It's about what it matters to us, and trying to delve into the lives of these people and try and find, oh, well, they wrote this because of this thing that happened to them or so on, is very reductive, really, anyway, when you're looking at literature.
Yeah, and if someone willingly has their letters or diary published or something, then I do find that really interesting. But I think probably more from looking at like, oh, what was professional life like for a writer in whatever period? How did publishing work? How did they share ideas with each other? And that still their personal life, but I think maybe less salaciously so, and not in, as you say, not in a way that is expecting to expose an understanding of the novel. Because I often feel quite disappointed. Like, I remember reading Chrome Yellow by Aldous Huxley and then discovering it was a Roman Clay afterwards, and everyone in there was very heavily based on real people. And I just was like, well, he's supposed to be a novelist, make up characters. I don't want them to be based on real people. If obviously there's an art to that too, but I was disappointed to learn more about his personal life, which made to me the art feel less of an achievement.
Yeah, I think it's you know, I'm quite a nosy person, and if information's out there in the public eye, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. But, you know, on a day-to-day basis, if I'm reading a book, I don't really need to massively know very much about that person at all, and I don't really see what it adds to what you're reading. So, you know, I'm not one of those people, and he wants to do that. And I think that authors who seek to be celebrities and so on are kind of missing the point. And that makes me respect them less, actually, the ones who court publicity and want to put themselves out there and, you know, want to use their writing as a kind of platform to be some kind of, advocate for something or other. I just think, you know, well, you're a writer, you know, who are you to tell me about this? You know, it's the same with Hollywood stars who want to make a point at the Oscars. I'm like, you know, guys, whatever. Where's your politics degree? Oh, yeah, you don't have one, so shut up. So, you know, it all feeds into that kind of atmosphere where I think, but coming back to what I initially said about thinking about, you know, that aside, whether we have a right to know or whether it's important, I think that the main issue around that now really is less about that, I think, and more about who is writing these books, who is being given an opportunity to have a voice and who isn't, and are those voices that we should be kind of applauding or rewarding when we know that their personal lives are very checkered or are abusive to others in some way. And I think it's a problem of our time, especially now where with social media and so on, information about people can spread so quickly, and sometimes false information too, so we do also have to be careful with that. But I think it's I think for a lot of people it really does matter about the person. And, you know, we see with obviously a lot of people due to the transgender debate don't like JK Rowling, for example, and won't read her books to their children, and you know, like, regardless of the quality of the book, they won't touch her with a barge pole. And there are, you know, people now who are talking about that with like Neil Gaiman and saying, oh, well, you know, it's a shame because now I won't read my child Coraline or whatever. And I don't know. For me, I don't feel that way, but I can understand and respect other people who do.
I think my sort of one exception to wanting to know personal details is if a novelist is writing a book about a person of faith as a sort of central character, whatever faith that might be. Like, I only really want to read it if it's by someone who's from that faith.
Right.
Like, just because I think it's such a contentious thing and people so often misunderstand things if they're not in that faith. And I just don't want to read a book about a Muslim by someone who's not Muslim, or a book about a Christian by someone who's not Christian. If that's a really central part of the narrative, if it's just like mentioned in passing, then sure, whatever. But I'm sort of sick of reading, I guess from my point of view, it's what happens now more often with Christianity now. It's sort of felt like free game for anyone to write what they like. But I don't really want to read about Christianity by someone who hasn't lived that life, which I'm sure there's other examples that come up. Actually, twins. I want to know if someone's writing about twins, are they a twin? I'll still read it if they're not, but that I will Google to be like, is this person a twin, or are they just going to make it up from the outside?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting one. I would say the same for me. Like, I'm interested, let's say if I read a book that's set in a particular place, I'm interested to know, oh, did the author grow up there, or is there some sort of connection to that place that's made them want to write about it? So I might Google for sort of information like that. Or like, you know, if it's about somebody who's been through a particular experience, I might Google to be like, they experience, you know, this particular illness, or, you know, I don't know, like some kind of other thing. I can't think of an example, but you know what I mean.
Some kind of other thing. And people say that we don't have the analysis.
No, I'm
kidding. I know what you mean. Yeah.
Say it's a book about boarding school. Did they themselves go to boarding school? Is this written from direct experience, or are they just basing it on stuff that they've read? I think those sorts of things can be interesting to know. But I'm only reading about them for the purposes of wanting to understand what's informed their writing, not necessarily because I really care about them as a person.
Yeah, I think that is a useful distinction. And sometimes that you can't find that answer, and you just have to work it out from the text, like people would have done before the internet. But I think, particularly if it's, I mean, not to link like these things, but if it is something like twins or having gone to boarding school or something where there are lots of stereotypes about it, for better or worse, in popular culture, then I think it is interesting to know if someone has that first-hand experience or is going to be basing it largely on those stereotypes.
Yeah. And that would probably influence whether I wanted to read the book or not.
Yeah. And as I say, I probably still would if it appealed for other reasons, but maybe I would read it more with a pinch of salt about how likely it was to reflect reality. Although, of course, a lot of novels aren't intended to reflect reality, and that's not what their main purpose is. So again, you have to take genre into account.
Yeah. It's a tricky old question, isn't it?
Yeah. Thank you, Lindsay. For example, I recently read a novel about twins who spontaneously combust constantly, and I was like, you don't need to be a twin to have written this. So that's fine. What was it called? Kevin Wilson, Nothing to See Here. Very good book, I recommend. So do you care about an author's personal life?
No, not especially, really. I can live without it.
Yeah, I think with a whole bunch of the caveats we've talked about, I'm with you. I'm going to say, yeah, I don't care. Thanks, Lindsay. Lindsay's actually sent lots of suggestions. And I think the last episode was also a Lindsay suggestion. So thank you, Lindsay. You're keeping to your books afloat. and we have a question from the middle, from Sumi. Thank you, Sumi, which is, do we like reading cookbooks? I know a lot of people talk about them as things they just, you know, enjoy to read. Obviously, might use them for cooking, but do you read cookbooks as books?
No, I don't actually. That's quite a simple answer for me. I've never been a big cookbook person. And I mean, I do own some. I rarely look at them. I often ask for them for Christmas and then forget that I have them. And then sort of Google recipes, and I feel like I've got this cookbook somewhere, and then I'll go, oh yeah, I do. It's not something I get. Food isn't something I get that excited about. I'm a kind of, you know, pizza and ice cream sort of girl. I'm not into fussy food, and the minute a recipe's got more than 5 ingredients, I'm never going to cook it anyway. So it's not something that excites me, though. I would say the one exception to that is that whenever I go to my sister's, she's got Nigel Slater's Kitchen Diaries, and I do love reading those because they are, that's a cookbook, but it's tied in with personal stories, and that I do enjoy. That's more like a book, but just a regular cookbook, no. What about you?
I'm also broadly a no. I do like cooking. I do often end up just going to BBC Good Food because it's such a good website. Yeah, so useful. I do love the idea of those ones that are half recipe, half memoir. Like, I never read for a regular cookbook, I never read the sort of, my grandmother taught me this when we're on a boat in Florence, whatever. But I do like the idea of the ones that are more like text, but with recipes in. But I have a thing both with normal recipe books and with that sort of thing, is I won't buy recipe books that have meat recipes in, because I'm vegetarian. I think it's a waste of money for me to spend it when there's meat recipes in. And also, I'm like, why would I get a book that's got pictures of dead animals in it? That's disgusting. So I'm very choosy. If anyone can recommend a sort of memoir style recipe book that is entirely vegetarian, then I would love to read it. But for me, I'm just, because I've been vegetarian so long now, that just I feel quite ill if I see pictures of meat or like stories about cooking animals, and I don't want that. So yeah, I need something catering to me. There we go. Sorry that we didn't provide any recommendations there if people were, you know, hoping when that topic introduced that we'd come up with some. But if, do let us know at teaorbooks@gmail.com if you have any suggestions, and maybe on the next episode we can share some.
Right, on to our tea books. Now, you've already slipped in that little teaser that one of these is not to your taste. Which would it be? We're all on tenterhooks. which would you like to introduce, Simon?
Shall I introduce The Lonely Passion of Judith Hearn?
Indeed, well, go ahead.
So it's a novel by Brian Moore about this woman who is, I guess, in late middle age, early old age, called Judith Hearn, who moves into a boarding house. People may know how much I enjoy boarding house novels in general. In the opening scene, she's putting up the crucifix above her bed, and she's obviously moved quite a few times. She meets She meets an Irishman recently back from New York called James Madden, who lives there. He's also the landlady. The landlady's sort of indolent son. This whole community of people that she's starting to get to know. But as the novel goes on, we realise that the word lonely is in the title for a reason. She is very cut off from people in general. There's this family that she goes to visit every week who sort of put up with her. But she doesn't really have human connection. But she does have hopes, maybe, that this James Madden might end up, even at this stage of her life, being the person who would want to marry her. I won't spoil whether that happens or not. But it's basically about her life and her increasing alcoholism as she deals with various sadnesses in it.
Yes, very sad book. Okay, so The Beautiful Visit is actually Elizabeth Jane Howard's very first book, and written in the 50s, but set in about 19, just before the war, about 1910, 12, like going up towards 1914. And there's an unnamed narrator who tells us the story of her life retrospectively, and she is at 16 at the beginning of the novel, and it's all about her life in this kind of very stuffy Victorian Kensington childhood where there's no money, and her father's a composer and her mother is, you know, very sweet but quite sort of vague and ineffectual. I think it's quite autobiographical, interestingly enough, from our previous discussion. Her desperation to escape and to do something with her life. She feels very trapped. And the beautiful visit of the title is a visit that she makes to, always seems to happen in these sorts of novels where these families have these extended second cousins and so on who invite people that they've never heard of before to Christmases and things. So she gets invited to this relation's house for a few days. It's her first time going away from home, and while she's there she gets exposed to this different way of life and meets these people, and most particularly a boy called Rupert, who kind of offer her a different vision of how her life may be. And then she goes back home, and then when war breaks out she finally plucks up the courage to leave and to get a job. Yes, that's and then on from there we see how her life opens up for her in different ways. So, Simon, start us off. What did you think of The Lonely Passion of Judith Hearn?
So this was actually my second time reading it. I read it 2019, during which it was one of my favourite books of the year. So I think it's a masterpiece. I think it's brilliant. So you can guess what I think of Beautiful Visit, but we'll come on to that. as you say, it's such a sad book. But not in a sort of clumsy or like, I think people, sometimes books are sad in what feels like quite a manipulative way. Whereas this one, the sadness comes from character and comes from a character being so well drawn. And I think what makes it so sad is that she has, as well as this loneliness and this isolation, she has total self-awareness. So she can't escape into fantasy. She has these fantasies, but she then chastises herself for them, like, no, it's never going to happen, you're never going to get married to this man. When she's going to this family, she, you know, it would be sad if the children were laughing at her in the background, or, you know, making it clear they didn't want to spend time with her. But it's so much sadder that she knows they're doing that and can't do anything to stop it, or to stop herself responding by putting on this bright, false, brightly cheerful voice, pretending that she's a beloved figure in their lives. So it is grueling to read at times, but I think brilliantly done. And I think she's a fascinating character. I think it's fascinating that a man wrote this character. It feels to me very authentic. Obviously, I'm not an older woman, either of this. Well, she's probably about my age, who knows? But I love it. What do you think?
Yeah, I found it a very painful book to read. I think you're absolutely right in that it's a brilliant characterization. And I was also very surprised by the fact that it was written by a man, and he's written with such sensitivity, and thinking about this woman who, through circumstances not of her own making really in many ways, has ended up in a situation where she's got nothing and nobody, and she's just an object of pity. And the fact that her only relationships are with people who keep up that relationship with her out of pity, and her realization of that, I think, towards the end of the novel is so unbearably sad. And she is, I think she's a kind of perfect representation really of women of a certain generation who were brought up only for marriage, nothing else useful, and if they weren't particularly attractive or didn't have any money, then became sort of unpaid carers really for other members of the family. And when that generation dies off, who have they got and who cares for them? And that kind of eking out of an existence on dwindling annuities and interest that's coming in, and having to go hungry because she can't afford, you know, she's only got a few pennies that she can afford to spend a day, and the smallness of that life, and the sadness of it and the emptiness of it, and then the sudden hope that she has that things might change, and then the realization that it's not. And it's just, I mean, it was just, I just couldn't bear it. By the end, I was just like, oh gosh, I just can't bear it for this woman, because it's the hopelessness of it. And then, you know, the fact that she's got nowhere, she's got no options, and it's just, nothing will change for her. And I think so often when we read books, it's all about, you know, people who are in a difficult situation, but, you know, things turn around for them, the miracle happens and everything's all right. And this is one of those books where those things never happen. And it's very realist in that sense, that for a lot of people, that, you know, good times never do come. They aren't able to turn things around. Nobody's going to come and help them. And this is just the reality of the situation, and there's nothing they can do to change it. And I, for that reason, I don't think I would ever read it again. But I think it was an incredibly well-written and moving book, with an incredible cast of characters. And I also love books set in Ireland. I love the Irish speech patterns. I think they're brilliant.
And there's so much in it about respectability in this sort of mid to, I can't remember exactly the decade, but whenever it is, in Ireland, or I'm sure in anywhere, but with the whole, you know, the boarding houses are so adamant about being respectable, so that when she does turn to alcohol, which again is done so poignantly, the way that, you know, she takes these long bus journeys to make sure she can buy alcohol in a place where she's not recognized. There's someone who takes, she won't give her any change for her money, and that's so devastating for her. Then people are washing their hands clean of her, thinking, we don't want someone like you in our house. And then someone tricks her into saying that she had a headache, and then says, well, actually, you were sort of clearly very drunk, all these sorts of things. There's so much of it, of the tragedy of her life, that you know, we're sort of used to tragedy being quite a glamorous thing in some books, where, you know, if it is devastating, then it's almost a heroic story of tragedy, or something that is like, you know, Keats or Shelley, or someone's going through this thing that can define the great poignancy of their art. And there's absolutely no glamour in her tragedy. It's like the opposite of glamorous. There's a real mundanity to the fact that there are probably thousands and thousands of women like her in this city. And nobody looks at their story and feels a swell of emotion about it within the novel, because it's such an ordinary tragedy. It's only when someone like Brian Moore crystallizes it into this sort of novel that it becomes so powerful to read, because you know this novel is the only place where she is important to anyone, because she's important to the reader. In real life she's no one's priority. She's always going to be like eighth or ninth on the list at best, and someone that is easy to dismiss by people who find it inconvenient to have to deal with her sadness.
And I think that's what's so kind of painful and difficult about this book is the fact that, you know, there are lots of people who are perfectly aware of what's happening to her and what she's going through, but she's not someone who's easy to have around, and she's a bit socially awkward. She's obviously quite prim and proper, and is a bit old fashioned really in many ways. Not great conversation, and those scenes where she goes to the O'Neills, he's her childhood friend and his wife and their children, and the desperation of all the children and him himself to get out of the way before she arrives, leaving his wife to deal with her. That idea that she's just a kind of burden, that we have to have her every Sunday and we have to be nice to her, but that's where it, you know, we'll do our 3 hours and then we're done for the rest of the week. And the woman in the board, you know, the woman who runs the boarding house, it's like, you know, I just want you out of here because you're not respectable, because you drink and, you know, you're causing difficulties, without anyone actually seeking to ask her, well, but why are you drinking and what can we do? There's no compassion really at all, apart from sort of towards the end, but even, and I think there was compassion towards her from the O'Neills at the end, but it's a bit too little too late really.
Yeah, and a sort of compassion that also has limits. Like there's a bit where she sort of flinches at seeing her child coming towards Judith and doesn't want them to be in the same space, that she sees that happen, and you know, gosh, it's just so so sad. By the way, also just want to say apologies for the sirens there, people listening. That's just, you know, what happens when one of our podcast hosts is in London, you get sirens. That's occasionally nice. Something that did strike me about these two books together is that it feels like the unnamed heroine of The Beautiful Visit could be a young Judith Hearn. There's this sense as the novel ends when she's much younger than Judith Hearn is, but she has many of the traits that could turn into something like Judith Hearn. She has this again, not being a priority in people's lives, sort of a sense of not being fulfilled where she's put, and a sort of quest for independence that has no certainty of being fulfilled, all of which could lead to someone becoming someone like Judith Hearn. That I found really fascinating, that when the narrator is quite young, there is that sort of glamour to that search for independence, and even a glamour to the fact that she is an outsider and has aspirations to better her life, and maybe she will achieve those, maybe we don't know, because the novel ends when she's still quite young. But reading them together, I was struck by, like, yes, this could be stage one of what eventually becomes Judith Hearn's life.
Yeah, I mean, I made the same comparison. I think it's really interesting to read The Beautiful Visit alongside it, because, I mean, initially we were like, are these going to be good? We always do.
We always find something.
And I think seeing that, the rigidity of that upbringing of, and, you know, at the beginning when she says to her parents that, you know, living pretty much in poverty, really scraping together money for things. And when she says, well, I want to get this job and I want to go and work in the library and it's going to bring me in, you know, £2 a week or whatever, even though that would genuinely have been a help to the household. You know, her father's absolutely horrified that she even thinks about taking a job. And, you know, girls like you don't work in places like that sort of thing. And it's like, well, you know, what sort of standards are you trying to keep up here? Because you can barely scrape together the money to put clothes on your children's backs, and yet you don't want one of them to get a job because it won't look right. And that sense of appearances being the most important thing, and keeping up those appearances, and letting that dictate your life, and letting that prevent you from making meaningful changes or daring changes or breaking away from tradition in order to make life better for yourself, is ridiculous, in the sense that I'd rather people, you know, not look down on me for kind of, you know, doing something different than actually live my life in a way that allows me to be financially comfortable is just bizarre to me. I'm like, why would you want to keep living in a situation where you've got no money and can't afford to do anything just in order to preserve this veneer that your respectable family is taking? But if that's what Judith Hearne grew up like, which is, you know, her aunt was very much like that, then you get the sense of why somebody who, unlike the narrator of The Beautiful Visit, who does have that desire to get out there and do something different and the bravery and the confidence to do it, you can see how they'd end up as a Judith Hearne. And I think there's lots of things to recommend The Beautiful Visit. I mean, one thing that has to be said is Elizabeth Jane Howard is a magnificent writer and the quality of the prose is excellent. And I did find it very absorbing to read and enjoyable to read, even though very little actually happens. And I don't have a problem with books where nothing happens. You know, both of us enjoy reading mid-century novels, and it really was quite a thing at the time. I think we're both okay with that. I think what I've struggled with a little bit with it is it feels very similar to lots of other books of around this period or slightly earlier. It feels like a novel really that should have been written 20 years before. And it reminded me very much of Dusty Answer, Invitation to
Yes, very much Dusty Answer, yeah.
Those sorts of books where, you know, you've got this ingenue girl coming out of this Victorian childhood and going out into the world and having her first dance and so on. And lots of, there's another book as well that it really reminds me of, and I cannot remember what it is. And I think it might be Dusty Answer. I'm confusing it with another one in my head. But what annoys me as well is these kind of cliches that you keep coming back to of the convenient distant family member that you can go and have a visit at and then, you know, suddenly meet all of these eligible young people who happen to be there. I mean, you and I have been to many house parties in our time, I'm sure. You never meet anyone that interesting at a house party. You always do in these sorts of novels. And then there's lots of randomly bumping into people on the streets and having these, like, oh, I haven't seen you in 20 years, and yet you happen to be at the same theatre as me. And we remember each other, even though the last time we met was, you know, ages and ages ago, and I saw you for 5 minutes sort of thing. and it's a little bit histrionic, I would say, in places, in that sense. And so it reads like something a teenager would write.
Yes, I think Dusty Answer by Rosamund Lehman was definitely the thing that came to my mind, because similarly, that's about I think it's an only child meeting this fascinating intellectual family, in that case next door. But yeah, I mean, as is clear, I didn't like this book. I think the characters are interesting. I think the prose is okay. I think it's not as good as her prose in later books. It's fine. But the reason I really didn't like it is because the structure is so poor. It feels like she had no idea what was going to happen. She just kept writing. It's like, well, this might as well happen next. Like, we often get suddenly dropped in a different scene altogether with whole new set of characters when she becomes like a help or a companion for this woman. Then that'll finish and she'll go somewhere else. And then we'll throw someone in she saw at the first house. But by then I've long forgotten who they are. And I mean, within scenes, there'll just be pages and pages of no sense of momentum, nothing interesting. Like, as you say, I don't mind a book when nothing seems to happen, but brilliant authors, like, you know, we mentioned R.C. Sheriff a lot, but he can do a book where you would say, oh, nothing really happens, but there is a real paciness to it somehow still. Whereas this is a book where nothing happens and it really feels like it. I was so bored by it and just had no reason to read on. And I think you've really put your finger on it with feels like books from earlier, because it feels like a novel written by someone whose experience of life at that stage was from reading novels, not from life. So it feels like she's cobbled together the different ideas she's had from reading books. And I think maybe I think there's an interesting thing in The Visit itself. Had the book been a novella, like 150 pages of going, maybe 120 pages of going on this visit and what she noticed, and then maybe the final scene is her coming home and being disillusioned or something. There's something interesting there, but the visit happens at the beginning and then it's forgotten about for ages, and then the war comes, so various people can die, and that's all very significant, but we don't really care about them because we don't know anything about them particularly. and she doesn't. Yeah, I mean, tragedies of, I mean, comparing these two, when you've got a tragedy that is an, a very normal everyday tragedy in some ways, but is dealt with so poignantly and in such depth, versus real tragedies are happening in The Beautiful Visit, but there is no sensitivity in the emotional description of them, and they sort of we then instantly move on to some other life event or group of people. So I got quite cross reading it, thinking, you're a talented person, you've wasted on this. And how did it win some, my copy says it won some prize for like best novel of the year or something. It's like, how? I don't understand. It
must have been a slow year is all I can think.
Yeah, it's just like achingly mediocre. And that, yeah, we both love her later novels. You've read more of them than I have. But yeah, this was not a promising book in my opinion. So she did well to then go on to write better things.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would slightly disagree with you in that I do think the writing is excellent. I love her prose, and I think there is a touchingness about it, and she's got a very good eye for detail and characterisation, and there's lots of, yes, moments of promise, but I completely agree with you that it reads very much like somebody who started writing a book and with no planning involved, no sense of where it was going to end. So it was just like, oh, well, actually, oh gosh, how convenient. It's now the war. Now I can write about it. And lots of characters who don't go anywhere. It's a series of vignettes strung together quite loosely. Mm, I think. Mm. And what is with the bizarre opening?
Yeah.
Very odd. She wakes up wrapped in a... First of all, I was like, she's wrapped in fur... And I'm like, is this some weird kind of like sex thing? Like, I don't know. And then, or like, is this a dream? And then
it's never referred to again.
Again, it's very bizarre. So there are issues. There are a lot of issues around the structure, and it needed a jolly good edit. But I think there is promise in there, and it shows what she's capable of, and gives. I think it's an interesting book to read if you like her very much as a writer, and you've read her later stuff and you've enjoyed the Cazalets and you'd like to see where she grows from. But if you want to read a book about a girl coming of age in this period of time, then I think you'd be better off reading Dusty Answer, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, also towards the end, curiously, like, she's clearly got, she turns a page of a notebook, just like, oh gosh, I wrote all these other things that might happen. I better cram all those in the last five pages. Sudden snowball towards the end, bizarre. But I'm glad you saw more promise than I did. If this was the first book I'd read by her, I'd certainly never read another one. But because it was not, I will continue to read her. I did want to mention, not really related to that, but I mentioned earlier about faith, and I think Brian Moore deals with faith so well in The Lonely Passion of Judith Hearne, because she does have, she's been a lifelong Catholic, and she has this crisis of faith, and it's dealt with so unsneeringly in a way that doesn't say whether she's right or wrong to have this crisis of faith, but sees it as the real impact it's having on her and the destabilizing impact it's having on her. So I thought it was dealt with in a really quite in poignant, beautiful way, without having to land on whether she has this, you know, come back to God moment or her complete disillusion. It didn't need that. It was more about the instability in a life that is already so unstable. And I thought he dealt with that so well.
I agree. I thought it was very, very beautifully written and powerfully written as well. And there's a lot about that book that will stay with me for a very long time. Some very, really powerful moments as well. Like when she's in the church and she goes to try and get behind the door. It's a very powerful book.
Have you read anything else by Brian Moore?
No. And I had not really heard of him before this book was mentioned. I think you mentioned this book and I happened to find it. Hello, Hargraves.
Hello.
I happened to find it in the bookshop and I picked it up, but I don't know what else he's written.
Yeah, I've read a handful, and I think he's done quite a few like bloody thriller type things, which I've not read. Just I've read the descriptions and thought, no thanks. But I really liked The Doctor's Wife, which is basically a sort of crisis in a marriage dealt with really well. And quite different, the Great Victorian Collection about a man who wakes up and discovers that masses of Victorian like pottery and furniture and stuff has appeared on his lawn overnight and can't work out why. So it's a very, very, very different style, but very enjoyable nonetheless. Oh, Hargreaves is pulling my headphones off. Hargreaves, stop it. Oh, there we go. You still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Let's get to decision-making time then, I guess. I will, unsurprisingly, be picking The Lonely Passion of Judith Hearn.
Yes, well, so will I, because it's a simply extraordinary book, and I think everybody should read it at least once. I mean, you probably only want to read it once, but...
Yeah, I had a 5-year gap, and then I was happy to read it again. So maybe you'll be ready one day. But
yeah,
yeah, just, gird your loins, and then you'll be ready. Great. Well, I'm so glad that you. It's hard to say you enjoyed it, but I'm glad you got a lot out of it.
Yeah.
In the next episode, we will be doing O Caledonia by Elspeth Barker and The Sundial by Shirley Jackson. So we'll be getting into like domestic Gothic territory next time. You can see a list of all the books and authors we mentioned at stuckinabook.com. You can find Rachel at booksnob.substack.com, and you can email us at tourbooks@gmail.com, and we hope you will.
Thanks so much for listening.
Bye.
Bye.